This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophy. Today's interview is with Christina Musholt, Professor of Cognitive Anthropology in the Department of Philosophy at Leipzig University. Her new book, Thinking About Oneself from Non-Conceptual Content to the Concept of a Self, is just out from the MIT Press. When Descartes famously concluded, "I think, therefore I am," he took for granted his ability to use the first-person pronoun to refer to himself. But how do we come to have this capacity for self-conscious thought? We aren't born with it, and while we may not be the only creatures that can think thoughts about ourselves, this ability does not seem to be very widespread. For starters, to be able to think of oneself, it seems one must first possess a concept of the self, of what the I refers to. In Thinking About Oneself, Musholt provides a naturalistic account of how self-conscious thought develops, how we may move from possessing implicitly self-referential information to having explicit self-representation, and how an entity that may think using non-conceptual resources can develop concepts that refer to items in the world, including, in particular, to oneself. Musholt defends what she calls a no-self view, in which the self is not an object that we refer to, but instead a mode of presentation, and that the development of a self-concept is driven by social relationships and the need for intersubjective information. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Christina Musholt.
Yeah, hello.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
So I'm looking forward to talking about your new book, Thinking About Oneself, from Non-Conceptual Content to the Concept of a Self. You give a what you call a no-self view, which itself sounds a little bit contradictory, but you do explain it, and we'll get into that. But before we begin getting into the book itself, maybe you could tell us a bit about yourself and your background. I mean, you're a philosopher of a professor of cognitive anthropology in a philosophy department, but you're a PhD and your background is in philosophy and cognitive science. So maybe you could say a bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on how far back you want to go, but I suppose I was always kind of interested in philosophy on the one hand, since I was a teenager, but also in biology, neuroscience, cognitive science for a long time. So initially, when I started studying at university, my plan was to become a neuroscientist. But then I kind of discovered that a lot of the questions that had fascinated me as a teenager, as I said, sort of continued to fascinate me, and that I couldn't really answer them or couldn't even really find them asked in the way that I thought they should be asked in the courses that I was taking as part of the biology and the neuroscience program. And so I started going to philosophy lectures and seminars and really found myself much more at home there. But for a long time, I couldn't really decide whether I really professionally wanted to be a philosopher or rather a natural scientist, partly, you know, because everybody says you'll never get a job as a philosopher and so on. But yeah, so anyway, even though I found neuroscience really fascinating, I did a master's degree in neuroscience, and I continue to find it very fascinating. Questions regarding, for instance, the nature of the self, what really makes us human, those sort of things I felt I couldn't really answer properly as a neuroscientist. And so therefore I decided ultimately to do a PhD in philosophy, although with a view to empirical sciences as well. So what I try to do in my research is really try to bring philosophy and empirical sciences, in particular the cognitive sciences, into some kind of fruitful dialogue with each other.
Okay, well, that the book certainly does demonstrate that. So you're considering the problem of what you sometimes call self-consciousness, or our ability to think thoughts that we about something that we refer to with the first person pronoun, the I.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what is gripping about this problem for you, or why it's a problem?
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, when you look at the history of philosophy, you sort of find that self-consciousness comes up and again in a lot of classical theories. It sort of takes center stage with a lot of philosophers. And I think that's no coincidence, because I do think that this ability to think I thoughts, to think about ourselves, lies at the heart of many things that we consider to be essential to what we are as humans, and what fascinates philosophers, including the ability to ask questions of moral significance, for example. But then the other thing that makes self so it's an ability that I think is very, very important and very dear to us, and therefore important to understand what that actually is. And at the same time, this kind of knowledge that we gain by thinking about ourselves, so self-knowledge, does seem to be rather different in some ways from the kind of knowledge that we gain about other objects in the world, and even other people, although in some ways it's different, in some ways it's not. But yeah, so I guess for reasons that we'll get into a little bit later, I suppose, this kind of way of accessing knowledge or information seems to be rather different from ways we have of gaining knowledge of other things in the world. And so that kind of makes it puzzling. So one way in which this puzzle is expressed is then in the failure of various traditional models that we do find in philosophy that attempt to explain this ability, which, as I try to show in the book, end up often either being circular or problematic in other ways, or essentially presupposing what they attempt to explain. And so in some level, this sort of the central question remains unanswered in a lot of these models.
Okay, one of the things that you bring up, you know, in terms of the circularity in particular, there are arguments that you go through at the beginning that are based on the idea that you're sort of on the model of reference that we have of concepts that refer to things, you know, a concept of a book, you know, and of course the word book will refer to various books, and we have names for people. But for reasons that you spell out, this particular relationship of having a concept refer to an object or the term for it, such as I refer to it, is kind of problematic and thought to be circular in the case of self-reference. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess one way of getting to the heart of this problem is by thinking about, well, let me, well, how do I try to explain this? Well, I think intuitively, perhaps a lot of us think that we have a very, there's a very intimate relation that each of us has of ourselves, right? So, I mean, Frege speaks of this very special way in which we think about ourselves and in which we can't think about other people or other objects. And you find this intuition expressed also in phenomenology, you know, people talking about this, the sense of mindness, this sort of primitive sense of self, the fact that we're always already acquainted with ourselves and experience, all these sort of thoughts, I think already point to this very special relationship that we have to ourselves. That's not, as a lot of phenomenologists are sort of quick to point out, it's not the relationship of something to an object. So, phenomenologists often say the way in which I'm aware of myself is not as an object, but as a subject of experience, as a subject of thought, as a subject of agency or action. And I'm very sympathetic to these ideas that are expressed in phenomenological traditions, though I often also find them a little bit mysterious. And so coming from the analytical tradition more myself, one thing that I try to do is try to combine these insights that we find in phenomenology with the sort of more analytical method of trying to spell things out that we find in analytical science. But yeah, coming back to this object model. So it's often said that the subject-object model kind of goes back to Descartes. And the idea is how do we gain knowledge about things? Well, it's by, you know, referring to them by standing in a certain relation to them, gaining information about them. Identifying them, picking out features. So for instance, with the books, you know, what makes a book a book? Well, there's certain features that identify a book as a book, and I can pick these out in perception and other modalities and kind of give a description of what makes a book a book. But the idea is that, again, with the self, that's not the case. And apart from this kind of intuition that the relation that we have ourselves is not that of relation to an object, we can see that this model can't apply to self-consciousness when we consider this regress problem that was first pointed out by Fichte in the tradition of German idealism, but then also has been popularized more recently by people like Manfred Frank, Dieter Henrich, and others in the German-speaking tradition and also in the analytical tradition by people like Shoemaker. And again, I think it also is echoed in the phenomenological tradition. And so the idea is if self-consciousness was a form of object cognition, we would end up with a kind of regress, because how do I know that a certain feature that I perceive is a feature of mine, that is a property that I can ascribe to myself? In order to know that, it seems I would already have to have some previous self-knowledge that would allow me to perform that kind of act of self-ascription. And so then we would end up in a kind of regress. And so the idea is that in order to stop that regress or to get self-knowledge or self-consciousness off the ground to begin with, there needs to be this kind of more primitive or more intimate knowledge that is always already there, as some people like to say. And I think that that intuition is right, but what I found dissatisfying, as I said before, in certain phenomenological ways of putting that, but also in the ways in which Manfred Frank and others are putting it, is that they say that it's kind of, you know, primitive and not further analyzable and, you know, somehow just there. And I think that's kind of dissatisfying. And so one of the things that I was trying to do is trying to see if we could maybe get a better grip on this kind of notion of this primitive sense of self or mindness.
Okay, so you reject the object, the subject-object model, and you call that the no-self view. Which is, as I mentioned before, it sounds sort of contradictory in the sense that you're giving an explanation of self-reference, self-consciousness, which says there is no self.
Right.
So could you explain that and how you resolve that issue with you introduce the idea or adopt the idea, I should say, of Mosev presentation. So could you say what the no self view amounts to and in your words?
Yeah, so well, let me start by saying that perhaps in retrospect that was not the smartest way of labeling my view. Uh-huh. as has been pointed out also, I think correctly by a review that Danza Havi gave of my book. I mean, I'll explain why I chose that label, but it can be misleading in the sense that I don't want to relate my view in any way to the sort of views that say that there is no self or the self is just an illusion or something like that.
Right.
You find those theories certainly in philosophy as well, and I don't want to associate my view with those kind of views. I don't think that the self is an illusion or that it doesn't exist or anything like that. The no-self also really doesn't refer to self-conscious states as such, but rather to the experiential states that I believe ground self-consciousness. So going back to this idea of this primitive sense of mindness that's meant to then ground kind of higher or more reflective forms of self-consciousness, as phenomenologists sometimes put it, I thought one view that, again, is coming like my own more from the analytical tradition that was perhaps promising to get a better grip on that is this theory of non-conceptual self-consciousness that was proposed by José Bermúdez. So I used that kind of as a springboard for my own book. The idea there is that, look, what explains our ability to think I thoughts, where, you know, most philosophers agree that I thoughts are really thoughts that do require concepts, at least those that we really then express linguistically when we actually, you know, say things like, I'm hungry, I believe this and that, I intend to do so and so. So what explains that ability? And Bermúdez's idea is that we have, so in a sense, there's a non-conceptual way of thinking about oneself that we're already born with and that we're also sharing with non-human animals. And the way he explains this is by saying that, look, take for instance a simple perceptual state, like, you know, I'm looking at this laptop in front of me now. The self is already there in that perceptual content, because effectively what it might seem to you that in looking at the computer, I'm just, you know, gaining information about the computer. But inspired by theories in psychology, in particular Gibson's theory of ecological perception, the idea is the self is also part of the content of that experience. For instance, I see this computer as being in a particular distance from myself. I see it at a particular angle, from a particular perspective, and I also perceive certain affordances, like I can type on the keyboard, I can move the computer around, I can close the lid, and so on and so forth. And so that information, the distance and orientation of myself in relation to the laptop, the ways in which I can interact with the laptop, that's information about myself, right? And so the idea is, look, the self is already there. And then what we do when we then turn to sort of more explicit forms of self-consciousness is just we use concepts and language to bring that out, to make that explicit, that the self is always already there. And I wanted, on the one hand, to preserve some insights here, which I think are right, but also wanted to modify that view by saying that it neglects an important distinction, namely the distinction that I make between implicitly self-related information and explicit self-representation. So I think, and that's where the no-self, coming back to your question now, comes in. Because I think that while it's true that there is information in the content of my perception that is related to myself or that concerns myself, for instance, concerning my possibilities for interacting with the objects in my environment, it's not true that the self as such is really there as part of the representational content. So the idea is that there's no self in the content of perception. The content of perception is just, you know, my perception is about that object that I'm perceiving, the laptop, and I'm perceiving certain relational properties that the object has, namely being related to me. But one of the relata, namely myself, is not represented. It's to use an idea of John Perry that I find quite helpful in the in getting to grip, getting a grasp on this idea, is that the self is an unarticulated constituent of the content of experience. So he has this very interesting thought experiments, which I found very helpful here, where he, you know, he says, consider these people called Zealanders on Zealand. They live on this island and they have no conception of the existence of any other place in the world. So now it's, you know, assume that they're talking about the weather. They say things like it's raining. Well, what are they referring to? In some sense, they're referring to Zealand, the place where they are. In fact, necessarily they're referring to Zealand because they're not aware of any of the existence of any other place. And so there is no way in which they could be referring to any other place. And yet, when you look at their utterances, they never mention Zealand. They never even mention indexicals like here, precisely because there's no need for them to do that because they don't have any conception of any other place that they could possibly be talking about. And so Perry actually himself draws the analogy to thought about oneself, and I think it's an apt analogy, the idea that, you know, because perception is always from my perspective necessarily, there's just no point in actually representing myself in the content of perception. Yeah. So what my perception is about, the content of perception really just is the objects in my environment and not myself. Yet the content of perception is obviously relevant to me and to my possibilities for interacting with the objects. And so when we acquire the self-concept, according to the view that I want to propose, is that we make explicit the self-relatedness that is implicit in the content of perception. Another way of putting that, which is the way that François Recanati puts it, and which I adopt in my book, is that he says, look, there's a content of perception on the one end, and then there's a mode of perception on the other. And so the content of perception, again, is about the objects in my environment, but the way in which they are presented to me is such that, you know, they're given to me from or presented to me from my perspective. And so that's one way of understanding this notion of mode. It's just from my egocentric point of view. And when I form an explicit I thought, such as I see the laptop in front of me, I make explicit this mode. I make explicit the fact that I experience the computer from my perspective in this particular way that's relevant to myself. But that doesn't mean that the self was there as the part of the content of experience before. And so, you know, when I have this I thought, then the self is, of course, explicitly represented and is there when I think I see the computer. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I don't think that. And in particular, infants who don't yet have conceptual abilities can't think it. And non-human animals who certainly already enjoy perceptual experience also can't think I thoughts. And so I would say contra Bermudis, that those animals and also infants at very, very early stages before they can have this ability to form explicit I thoughts, they're not really self-conscious in the sense of, you know, there is no self in their content of experience. Sorry, that was very long.
No, actually, no, I was, that was very clear. And I wanted to, let me just follow up for a second. So the objects of perception are just the objects in the world, and they're sort of self. There's an egocentric perspective that we always have on those, and then at some point, that sort of self-related information becomes explicit self-representation.
Right? Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So then what is, when you have explicit self-representation, what is the object of the thought at that point?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, so like I said before, what you perceive objects and their properties, and some of which are relational properties related to yourself, but you as one of the relata, you're only there implicitly. And so then when you form an explicit I thought, an explicit self-representation, you make that explicit. And so you're attributing to yourself the property, for instance, of being situated in a particular distance from the laptop, or of being able to interact with the laptop in a particular way. And so, yeah, so then in that sense, you're thinking about yourself, and in particular with respect to whatever it is that essentially you're thinking. You know, you might be thinking, look, I can reach the lid and close it, or I can't because it's too far away. And so you're thinking of yourself in terms of that property of yours, of being in a position, for instance, to reach the object or not reach it or interact with it in a certain way. Okay. Let me also say, I mean, one thing that might be slightly misleading too about the book, in a way, is that it doesn't quite put in. So I focus a lot on these sort of what I take to be, well, fundamental, perhaps we can say, fundamental forms of thinking about oneself, which then I think enable other ways of thinking about yourself. But of course, it's not to say that we never think about ourselves as objects literally. So we can make ourselves an object of our thought and of our experience as well. It's just that if we weren't aware of ourselves as subjects in the first place, subjects being in a position to interact with our environment in a certain way, we couldn't form thoughts about ourselves as objects either, you know, because of this regress problem that I mentioned at the beginning. But obviously both kind of go hand in hand together. And I think the self-concept also in a way involves both sort of modes of thinking about oneself. That's why the mirror test is kind of gives an important clue here, because what happens when I learn to recognize myself in the mirror is really that I combine this kind of internal mode of experience of myself that I have with this realization, oh, I'm also an object that can be perceived, just like I can perceive objects, an object in the sense of being able to be identified by others, and then also by myself, insofar as I can look at myself through the lens of others, so to speak.
Okay.
Sorry, maybe that might have been a bit.
Yeah, no, it's it's so. Let me just again follow up a little. So, mm-hmm. I mean, once we're talking about self-reference, I mean, does you know, we started talking about objects of perception, you know, ordinary things like books and the egocentric perspective that we have on them, and that becomes a eventually somehow some sort of reference to the self. And my question was, is at that point, or is perception the right sort of access or sense that we should be talking about? I mean, is it?
No.
Yeah.
No. So, I mean, at the level of self-reference, I think what we're concerned with is actually judgments. It's a form of, you know, it's a form of judgment to explicitly self-attribute these properties to myself. And these judgments can be grounded in the perceptual experience, but I don't think that self-consciousness or thinking about oneself should be thought of in terms of in a sense or perceiving oneself or something like that, because then we'd essentially be back to the subject-object model,
right?
Which is not to say that we can't perceive ourselves, right? So I mean, I can look at myself in the mirror, and of course then I am perceiving myself, and that's one way of thinking about myself then as an object of perception. But in the cases where I'm just looking at the laptop and then self-describing the thought, I'm seeing the laptop on the basis of just seeing the laptop. That's not a case of perceiving myself.
Okay. So let's talk about the transition here. I mean, we start. You talked about José Luis Bermúdez's idea of the non-conceptual content. You give a particular interpretation of the non-conceptual content of, a baby or a pre-linguistic infant who doesn't have concepts and yet in some sense does have some egocentric perspective for sure. One of the things you do is to interpret non-conceptual content in terms of knowing how rather than knowing that. Right. So that's one important step. Just what is non-conceptual? What positive can one say about non-conceptual content? We don't want to just say, well, it's just content that's not conceptual.
Right.
But beyond that, you also give a fairly let me start with that because the next question is just how one gets from the non-conceptual to the conceptual, right? So take the non-conceptual first. What is that on your view?
Again, very good and difficult question. I think I saw a quote from Davidson the other day where he sort of mentioned that he's glad that he's not a developmental psychologist because he essentially has no idea how to talk about the cognition of non-linguistic, non-conceptual creatures. And he thinks it might even be an impossibility in some sense to talk sensibly about it. Because obviously, we're always, in talking about that, we always have to use concepts and we have to use and therefore think in language in some ways. And so it's very hard to get a grip on these non-linguistic, non-conceptual forms of apprehending the world in a certain sense. And I think it's also, this aspect of, what really positively can we say about non-conceptual content? I felt like, you pointed out correctly, that it's sort of dissatisfying to just define non-conceptual content in opposition to conceptual content, and so to just give a negative definition. And I felt that this idea of knowledge how is one way of maybe approaching a positive account of non-conceptual content, but I don't take myself as having worked out a full theory at all, or not even sort of approximating a theory of what non-conceptual content might be. So it's really just, a little bit of hand waving that I do in the book at that point. But yeah, so the idea is, and again, that's something that I found in reading, for instance, Adrian Cassin's work on non-conceptual content, quite illuminating, is that he says, look, there's just different ways of apprehending the world, different ways of interacting with the world, and not all of them are constrained by conceptual abilities, and not all of them conform to what he calls the norms of truth. Yeah, they're not all truth evaluable. So when we talk about conceptual content, we can always ask, is that representation true or false? Does it give an accurate picture of the way things are? And with non-conceptual content, thinking about it in terms of knowledge how sort of hints at the fact that we have a lot of ways of a lot of practical ways of interacting with the world that are not so much about are my representations true or false, but rather how skillful am I in doing certain things? Can I ride the bike or can I not ride the bike? And so I was trying to get to some of those insights by relating the notion of non-conceptual content to the notion of knowledge how. It's also, I think, again, respecting insights from phenomenology, although I didn't sort of discuss these in detail. When Heidegger, for instance, talks about being in the world and sort of, seeing the world in terms of the things that are around us, that are there for us, ready for us to do something with in a certain way. I think it's very hard to impossible to translate that kind of knowledge of how to interact with the things and the people in my environment, to translate that into really something propositional, conceptual.
Okay. So let me get to the sort of the meat of the book. At least as I think of it, is that your account of the transition, right? That's kind of critical. That's, I think, an important contribution to this literature in the book. So we start with this implicitly self-referential information, right? Which, you know, the idea, you know, we're born with an egocentric perspective. And, you know, so, it, you know, I don't know which things will have that, but many things will, that don't have language, that don't have concepts and so forth. And then there are steps to get us to the end game, which is, you know, the ability to think about oneself, to, you know, use the word I and so forth. And you describe this, and this is just a very brief thing, as a process of redescription over various various stages. So could you explain how you get from the beginning, you know, to this sort of actual full-blown concept of the self?
Right. So, I mean, again, you're right that this is kind of the heart of the book. At the same time, it's also a part where a lot of questions remain open that I'm continuing to work on. But generally speaking, so this idea of representational redescription is an idea that I didn't come up with by myself, but rather something that I found in the literature on development of psychology. It was coined by Annette Camilla-Smith, who's a developmental psychologist. And she doesn't talk about self-consciousness specifically, but she was just talking about cognitive development in more general terms. And she thinks that we have, you know, information implicit in forms of procedural knowledge or knowledge how, as I sort of tried to explain earlier. And she thinks that there's a process that makes available that information that's initially kind of domain specific, and again, as she says, implicit in forms of procedural knowledge. That information is made increasingly available to other parts of the cognitive system via increasing levels of abstraction, which essentially then leads to more cognitive flexibility, to more domain generality, at the expense of speed, automaticity, etc. It kind of relates a little bit to this two systems way of thinking about cognition that we find very prominently in the literature at the moment, where the idea is that, you know, you have this fast, you know, Kahneman's idea of this sort of thinking fast and slow. You have this fast way of thinking, which is based on heuristics, on automatic processes, which is, you know, very fast, but it's not very flexible, and it's prone to certain biases. And then you have the slow way of thinking, which is abstract, conceptual, but also much more cognitively demanding and so on. Except that what I like about Camilla Smith's approach is that it goes beyond saying there are just these two ways and saying there's actually many levels in between. And she talks about there being four different levels, but I think her account in principle is open to there being many more than four. And it also gets us beyond this kind of dichotomy that I find problematic in talking about non-conceptual versus conceptual content, which again suggests that there's just these two ways that we have of apprehending the world. You know, one is, again, knowledge how, it's procedural, non-conceptual. The other is conceptual, abstract, etc. And I think, A, that leaves it mysterious how to think about the relation between the two, but it also doesn't quite give enough, it doesn't do justice to the actual complexity of the cognitive beings that we are. And so that's what I like about Camilla Smith's approach. It has these different levels. And so I try to then take this idea of this gradual representational redescription, which she details with respect to cognitive development, generally speaking, and applying that then to the problem of self-consciousness and the question of how do we get from perception that's non-conceptual and has implicitly self-related information to conceptual, explicit thinking about myself.
I was going to say it might be worthwhile if there's a I don't know if you have an example or a particular feature of the self that might get, you know, be the end point of one of these processes of redescription.
Yeah. Maybe actually let me start with actually not necessarily an example of self-consciousness, but rather an example that's more general relating to cognitive development, which I personally found very illuminating when I was reading Camilla Smith's work. So she talks about research with children where they're asked to balance sort of objects on a beam and sort of, you know, find the center kind of the object that makes it sit stable on this beam. And as in many actually studies in development of psychology with this ability as well, you typically find a U-curve kind of development. So that is, there's a point at which children can't do it, then they certainly get very good at doing it, and then suddenly they can't do it again when they get older, and that's kind of weird, right? Mm-hmm. And so she tries to explain this is precisely in these terms of representational redescription. So what she says what happens initially is that you have this procedural, this ability, this knowledge how to balance certain objects, but it only works for particular objects. So the way that the experiment works is that the objects are manipulated by some have sort of a weight glued to one of their ends, and so or sometimes the weight is hidden at one part of the object, and so the center isn't where you would normally expect it to be. And so initially she says the children just take each individual object, they look at each object as a separate problem, and they just try to sort of balance it. And they're just using proprioception and feedback, and they manage to balance each object individually on this beam. Sorry, I actually made a mistake in talking about the U-curve. Of course, the idea is that first you have the ability, then you don't, and then you have it again. I was sort of saying it the wrong way around before. Yeah. Okay. So these very young children have this ability. And then suddenly they kind of lose it. What happens is they can only balance objects that actually have their center in their middle. And why is that? Well, she talks about them developing some kind of theory in action. So they have made a lot of experience over the past few years with different objects, and they found that normally they balance at their center. And so they have no problems with objects that do, in fact, follow that kind of proto-theory. But when they confront objects that don't follow that theory, they don't know what to do with them. And they kind of just exclude that. They put them aside and sort of just say, okay, that doesn't fit my model, it doesn't fit my theory, I don't know what to do with that. And she thinks the theory, as it were, needs to become solidified, needs to become accessible enough to them for them to actually consciously access it and then consider the merits of the theory before they can then, when they're older again, incorporate data that isn't fitting and actually then sort of develop the correct theory of how objects balance. And so that expense is kind of U-curve. And so the idea is that, again, at first you're just relying on proprioception, you're relying on kind of ways of interacting with objects. Then once you've mastered that, you kind of try to extract somehow common features from your experiences, such as in this case, most objects balance at their center, have their center of balance at their center. And then you use that theory, although you can't articulate it yet, it's not really conceptually available yet, it is somehow there. You have extracted something abstract from your previous interactions with the objects, which then guides your future interactions with them. And then eventually that theory or that information becomes really consciously, conceptually accessible, such that you can then really consider its merits again. And so the question then is, so what sort of triggers that, or how do you prompt to form these more abstract representations? How are you prompted to form these more abstract representations? And I think that's actually one of the sort of still very much open questions. But it seems to be somehow that in humans anyway, once we've reached a level of behavioral mastery with something, we're trying to kind of understand it at another deeper, more abstract level. And one thing that now relates in some sense to what I was trying to do in the book, but that I wasn't really, that I hadn't really worked on sufficiently yet in the book and that I'm trying to work on now, is the role of social interactions actually for that, the kind of role that social scaffolding has actually. Jennifer Greenwood, who's some interview I heard on your program, and that, which prompted me to read her book, actually. So she talks about social scaffolding. And I think that's very important to look at social interactions. But so now coming back to self-consciousness. So I think that with self-consciousness, we also go through a process like that. So the child has ways of interacting with the world, and that contains, like we said earlier, implicitly self-related information about the child, but somehow it's not focused on extracting that information as, you know, being about the self. And then what prompts that extraction in the case of self-consciousness? Well, actually, social interaction, although I wasn't thinking about it as much in terms of social scaffolding yet, but more in terms of, well, why would we actually start thinking about ourselves as subjects or objects in the world, as separate entities, as beings?
Right.
Going back to, no, sorry, I think I made this unnecessarily complex, but... Okay, perhaps.
No, well, I was going to follow up with the social aspect,
yeah.
So just go ahead.
So you might have to edit this a little bit, I'm not sure. But so going back to, Perry that we talked about earlier, right? So he has this idea, okay, Zealanders have no conception of other places. So they're necessarily referring to Zealand, but they're not explicitly referring to it. When would they explicitly refer to their location, or why is it that we actually have indexical notions like here and that we do explicitly refer to locations? Well, obviously, because we do have a conception of other places, and so sometimes we need to draw a contrast between one location and another. Like it might be raining where you are, but it's not raining here, and so on. And actually, Bermudez has a similar idea as well in his book when he says self-consciousness is essentially a contrastive notion. So what we're doing when we're thinking explicitly self-conscious thoughts is we're contrasting ourselves with others. And so the idea is that once I develop a conception of there being other beings with their own perspective on the world that might differ from my own, it makes then sense for me to think about my perspective on the world explicitly as such. So now what I was trying to do in the book is combine these two basic ideas. So this general model of cognitive development that Camille Smith sketches, where she has these different stages of representational abstraction. Mm-hmm. And this idea that self-consciousness is related to intersubjectivity in the sense that it's only once I become aware of others that I also at the same time become aware of myself as such, as being different from these others. And chapter five tries to develop this more general idea based on Camille Smith, and in chapter six of my book tries to put these two ideas together and then sketch the developmental trajectory for self-consciousness through different stages. And I try to illustrate that then by appealing to developmental psychology, sort of distinguishing what happens, for instance, when the child learns to engage in acts of joint attention at the age of 9 months. How's that different from being able to recognize yourself in the mirror? And how's that different again from really showing explicit abilities for empathy and then later really developing a theory of mind and thinking about others and yourself explicitly as representational beings, for example?
Right. I mean, that was one of the things as you were talking, and the recognition of other beings that have a different perspective, or the recognition that there are other things that you wouldn't want to say other beings that do what I do in terms of a relationship to the world, because that would be too sophisticated. But do we need to have a theory of mind before we have a concept of the self?
Yeah, good question. It depends a bit what you mean by concept of the self. So, I mean, one of the things that I've come to sort of think as I was writing the book is that these yes or no answers are not really available to us in some level. You know, I said earlier, cognition is very complex, and there's many different levels or degrees. I'm not sure levels or degrees. I'm not always happy with those expressions, but yeah. So, I mean, in that sense, I think you can also distinguish degrees of self-awareness. And so it depends really what you mean. when you talk about the self-concept and the self-ascriptions that you're performing by applying the self-concept. I think there's sort of relatively basic, simple self-ascriptions that you can perform in the absence of a full-blown theory of mind, but then really thinking of yourself as a being that has a representational state, that has mental states, that, of course, by definition, implies some kind of theory of mind anyway, and that theory of mind would then apply to yourself and to others. But yeah, I mean, the term theory of mind, of course, itself has now in the cognitive science literature become a matter where people, you know, like in Apperly and Stephen Butterfield talk about something like primitive mind reading, primitive theory of mind. So even there, there's different degrees and different levels, which makes it very hard to sort of answer a question like that in a sort of yes or no
sort of way. Right, right. I guess, you know, because there's, I mean, for some people, of course, it's passing a false belief task. And for others, there's, like Butterfield, you know, it's something a bit more primitive, as you mentioned. Well, let me ask, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to ask about, you know, there's been a lot of work recently on, you know, on theories of the self, as well as the nature of agency, which is kind of lurking in the background here, although I don't know if we'll get to that. But so there's a number of different theories on offer of the self, you know, the narrative self, the Dennett or some people, you know, as you mentioned before, that the self is an illusion. Mm-hmm. I think Sean Gallagher has a work on, you know, the sort of phenomenology of the self. Mm-hmm. How does your view relate to these different sorts of ways of thinking about the self? You know, whatever it is that we end up with when we use, you know, I, you know, the first person pronoun, there's a lot of different views of that. Do you have any preferences among these? Are you completely neutral among them, or are there some that appear to be more justified, perhaps, you know, given the way you think that the self develops or self-consciousness develops?
Yeah, so I mean, in the book, I don't really take an explicit stance on, you know, the metaphysical question of what really is the self. And I don't really have a theory on that either. It's more, perhaps, more an intuitive way at that point of approaching this question, where I tend to think, yeah, the self is the person. But I also think that a lot of these different theories, that each of these different theories points to something right and important. So, I mean, obviously, I think it is true that we do have a narrative self-conception. Yeah, we tell stories about ourselves and about others, and I think that is an essential part of what then comes to be our personal identity and what maybe even constitutes personhood in a certain way. And so I think, in a sense, there is this narrative self. But as I was saying earlier, I think the phenomenologists certainly have a point, too, when they say, look, that can't be all there is to us. And in fact, Dan Zahavi tries to combine, you know, ideas of the narrative self with this kind of more primitive, more basic notion of self-awareness that I think you called the phenomenological self, that Gallagher also talks about. I think there's certainly that as well, although I sort of disagree with them when they talk about these sort of very primitive notions of self-awareness. I think we should distinguish between awareness and self-awareness, just for the reasons mentioned earlier, namely that awareness, while containing implicitly self-related information, is not a form of explicit self-representation. And I'd like to reserve the term self-consciousness for the latter. That's partly a terminological question, though. Leaving that to the side, I think there's an important intuition in phenomenological conceptions of the self that I would want to preserve. So I think all of these theories also, you know, theories of talking about the self as being, you know, the body playing an important role there. I mean, I give quite a lot of space to bodily experience and bodily self-awareness. in my book as well. I think that's also an important part of the self in a way. And when we think I thoughts, you know, we can think in different ways about ourselves. We can think, as I said earlier, about ourselves more as the subject of experience. We can also make ourselves the object of our thinking and of our experience. And we can emphasize different aspects of selfhood or of personhood that we want to think about. You know, we can think about our bodies. We can think about our life stories or histories. We can think about particular mental states that we're in or that we've been in. So, yeah, I guess I feel that a lot of these theories, yeah, that there's not really competition necessarily between them.
Okay. There is one question. As you were talking earlier, giving the example of kids who, you know, find a center of gravity to balance various objects and then abstracting to say, oh, the center, and then making all kinds of mistakes until they manage to make their theory a bit more explicit. And I was thinking about about character traits.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes – so one of the open questions that you raise, you know, towards the end of the book is about, you know, the integrity of the self-concept over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, character traits, of course, are would have to be any story about that would have to say something about character traits because mm-hmm. those are presumably maybe you should tell me abstracted in some way from mm-hmm. interactions with with other people. But so how do character traits fit in here? And then there are people, of course, in social psychology who, you know, deny there is such a thing as character, which isn't necessarily contradictory to, you know, the role of character traits, you might say. So could you you don't really talk about this much, so I'm pushing a little bit beyond what the book says.
No, I'm glad that you're actually asking that question because it brings me actually to something that I really wanted to mention in this interview, even though, as you say, it wasn't really part of the book. So in the book, what I really focus on is just trying to get a handle on this ability to really think explicit thoughts about my current mental and bodily states, and perhaps very basic sort of memory states, but that isn't really my focus in the book. So I'm really thinking, you know, what concerns me in the book is this question, how do I move from seeing an object to then self-describing that perceptual state and sort of thinking I am seeing this object there? And for that, you know, I was appealing to things like, you know, how do you develop a theory of mind essentially through social interaction and so on. But that doesn't really touch at all on this question of character traits, like you say. And I think that's an important point. And it's also actually something that I've started to think about a little bit more recently. At the moment, I'm teaching a seminar on different kinds of self-knowledge. And we've been reading some of the work, amongst others, by Kasim Kassam, for instance, who emphasizes, you know, that, look, there is this kind of self-knowledge that philosophers talk about a lot and which I, in my book, talk about a lot, you know, like self-description of basic bodily mental states. And that's, I think it is interesting because it's, as I said earlier, fundamental for our other ways of talking about ourselves. And so I think it's legit, and it has these special characteristics or features that other types of knowledge don't have, such as, for instance, immunity to error through misidentification and other things which we didn't really talk about, but which make this kind of special. But I think he has a very good point, too, when he says, look, but there's also other types of self-knowledge, which is, you know, when the Greeks talk about know yourself, and when you talk about lay people, when you talk to them about self-knowledge, what they associate with self-knowledge, that's not really touched upon by these theories. And that includes things like, how do I know what kind of person I am? What kind of character traits do I have? And do I even have stable character traits? Or are my actions more driven by situational factors, right? So that's one of the theories that I think you were mentioning that situationists say that character traits don't really exist. They don't really explain our actions because it's really depending on the situation and the context what we're doing, with appeal to several empirical sort of studies in moral psychology. And that is what he calls, what Kassam calls, the sort of substantial self-knowledge, which is very often relies on actually observing ourselves, on it relies on testimony, relies on really taking maybe a more detached stance on ourselves and really taking a hard look at our actual, at the things that we actually do, rather than just at the things that we believe and our, that what we take to be our current mental states and things like that. And yeah, so it was important to me to point out that although that's not my focus in the book, and I focus on not thinking of oneself as a subject in the book, that's by no means to say that that's the only way of thinking about yourself or even the most important way. Now, with respect to the question, do character traits exist or not? I think it would require another full-hour interview to fully debate this question. You know, based on my reading of the literature in moral psychology, I don't think that these studies that people point to when they deny the existence of character traits, that they really are fully convincing and that they really undermine this notion of character traits as it is developed in, for instance, you know, virtue ethics and other places. Mm-hmm. But it certainly requires often hard and difficult work to know what character we have, and we can be mistaken with that. And it might perhaps be in certain situations less explanatory for the kinds of things that we do than we normally think. And so, there's all kinds of fascinating questions with respect to that. And how do children learn about their characters? Again, you know, I think that's... that requires a lot of social interaction, talking to others, asking others, you know, what you think, or actually just getting feedback from others, you know, about things that they do. And kind of looking at oneself through the eyes of others and sort of really finding out what kind of person am I.
Good. Well, we're sort of out of time, actually.
So many questions.
I know, and there's so many questions to ask, but, you know, hopefully the listeners will look at your book on their own, and there's a lot more to talk about. But to end the interview, could you say a bit about what you're working on at the moment? I mean, are you continuing with the same... You sort of mentioned before you're going to some of the open questions, but what are you working on now?
Yeah, so several different things. One of the questions that we talked about earlier is, you know, how do we get from this knowledge how to the knowledge that? Put differently, how do we acquire concepts? How do we enter, to use a phrase by Sellers that I like, the space of reasons, more generally speaking, independent of self-consciousness? That's a question that I'd like to look more at, and in particular with respect to that question. Like I said, I want to focus a bit more on this role of social interaction, on, you know, social scaffolding, and also education, and the role that education really plays for that. So sort of building on ideas by people like Jennifer Greenwood, but also David Beckhurst and a lot of other people. So that's a question that I'm interested in. And I'm actually working with a colleague on also thinking about more practical implications that might eventually have for the way in which we teach children how to think, for example, in daycares, centers and schools and so on. And the other question is really staying a bit closer to self-consciousness. You know, like I mentioned, what other types of self-knowledge and thinking about ourselves are there, and how do we sort of bring together these different forms of self-consciousness? And also in relation to that, since I say in the book, look, there's different levels of self-awareness. In parallel to that, I try to spell out different levels or different ways of being aware of others. And so that's another question that I'm interested in, how do various theories of social cognition, you know, some listeners might be familiar with this debate between stimulation theory, narrative practice hypothesis, the interaction theory, you know, all these kind of theories, how do they relate to each other? What kind of account can we give of the different ways of knowing not just ourselves, but also others. So yeah, that's.
That's a lot.
That's so a lot.
I wish you luck with that. But I appreciate you taking the time now to talk with New Books in Philosophy. And good luck with all those different projects.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thanks very much for the opportunity to talk about my work. And I apologize for some of the long-windedness in some of my answers.
No reason for that. You've been listening to my interview with Christina Musholt, professor of cognitive anthropology at Leipzig University. We've been talking about her new book, Thinking About Oneself, From Non-Conceptual Content to the Concept of a Self, which is out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thanks again for listening.